What I'm going to do is I'm going to cover 12 chapters in 1 hour and a half period. Because the first 12 chapters of the book of Isaiah are a single unit. And because it's prophecy, and because the prophetic mind, and especially writing some 2,000 years ago, or 2,500 years ago to 2,600 years ago, because they thought of things differently, they don't necessarily go in the order that we do, which means you kind of have to read chapters 1 to 12 a whole lot of times before you can really see that the whole thing interrelates. What I'm going to do is we're not going to be able to read through all of 12 chapters. That would be impossible. But we're going to skim through 12 chapters. I'm going to highlight the key issues, and then you'll see that those key issues relate to each other. And I'll keep one page blank, and what we'll try to do is we'll try to kind of build a map. We'll build a map of how the first 12 chapters look. Now, what's interesting is everybody recognizes that the first 12 chapters are in a unit. First of all, at the end of chapter 12, you have the famous Hine El Yeshuati, Eftach Lo Chad, Ki Oziv Zimradiah Hashem, Vayidi Yeshua, Ushaktiv Mayim Sason Yina Yeshua. You all recognize this from the Havdalah services at the end of Sabbath. Martin Biomahu, and you shall say in those days, Hodu Lashem, blessed be God, or thanks to God, Kiru Bishmo, call in his name, Hodiu Ba'amim Alulota, tell all the nations of his plans, has cured King Isgachmo, and remind everybody that his name is on high. So there's a real ending here. What happens afterwards, just to take you quickly into it, is there are a series of masas. A masa is a vision. It means literally a travel, but in this case it's a prophetic travel. And there are a series of masads that last all the way to chapter 35. And each masad is referring to a different country that Isaiah is prophesizing for. And he's really prophesizing outwards, although everything relates to what also happens in Israel. But he prophesies to all the nations, and the first nation he's prophesizing is to Babel. In the second chapter, the chapter afterwards, you have, you have Masa Moav, a prophecy of against the Moabites. And then there's a series of prophecies, Masad Damesek, a prophecy of Damascus, and a series of sort of international prophecies. But that's what happens from chapter 13 to chapter 35 or 36, I don't remember. And then afterwards there's a new section, so we'll deal with that later. The first section of the book is from chapter 1 to chapter 12. So what we need to do is take a look at it, and I'll try to demonstrate that they're really a unified item. Why do you think? That they're really a unified item. And I'll try to show you the major themes that we'll look at the big structure, and then there's some really nice little structures inside the big structure. And we'll try to analyze a little bit of that. And I'll try to show you the themes that flow through the first 12 chapters. And I'll show you that this is actually a very readable story, which is only not readable because it's a hard text to read. But if you kind of read it at about 100 times, you really start to really see the pattern. So what I'll do is I've read it about 100 times. So what I'll do for you is I'll show you the patterns, and then when you're reading it, you'll hopefully be able to see the patterns quite easily. I've never tried a shiur like this where I did 12 chapters in one and a half hours, so I may fail, but we'll see how it goes. And the story begins with, there is probably the most, besides Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzva'ot, probably, and you don't have it in your handouts, I actually did not put it in your handouts, probably the most famous thing in all of Isaiah, one of the famous passages in Tanakh, and a core prophecy of Isaiah is this song called the Shirat of the Kerem, or the Shir of the Kerem. Has anybody ever heard of it before? It's kind of a famous prophecy in verse 5, and I'm going to go through it quickly, and there's some amazing stuff. We can spend a whole shir on this, but I think what I'm going to do is, oh, you know what? Let me do it in Hebrew and English. I should do this in Hebrew and English. And I'll go to a Hebrew English Tanakh, and that'll make this core a little bit easier to read and to understand. Parallel Hebrew and English. The translation is the old JPS, which is based on the King James. It's not the best translation, but it will do for now. Isaiah chapter 5. If you remember last week, we did chapter 6. So now we're going to do just the first few lines of chapter 5, and we'll use that as a jumping point for the book, for the first section of the book in its entirety. Ashira na li didi, shirat dodi the charbo, karam ayali didi the karam ben shabbos. It's actually a beautiful poetry. Let me sing now. Ashira, ashir means I will sing. Ashira means let me sing. It's a request form. Let me sing a song for the sake of my friend, who apparently can't sing for himself. That's going to be God. We'll see in a second. Shirat dardi likarmo. In this case, the second lamed means about. A song of my friend about his vineyard. And now the song starts. Kerem hayali didi, my friend, my beloved, or my close friend, had a vineyard in the corner of Ben Shaman. Shaman means fat or oily. What it means is he had a really good piece of land. He had set up a vineyard in the choicest piece of land. Vayazkehu, vayasaklehu, vayitaehu sorek. He pulled out all the stones from it. He sort of got it all ready. He probably put a ring of stones around it. We could do the English, but the words are very difficult. But the basic idea is he prepared the ground well for his parent. Vayiven migdal betocho, and he put a migdal is a tower inside that he can watch over his vineyard to make sure that nothing bad would happen to it. Vagam yekev chatzeifo, he was so confident about his vineyard that he put a yekev, which is a stepping press. If you've ever seen it, it looks something like there's flat stones, and then you have a little bit of a pipe, and then you have a kind of a depression in the earth. And what they would do is they put all the grapes here, and they'd step on the grapes, and the liquid would flow through this little, like, a crack, essentially, and fall into this, which is the yekev, so a place to hold the grape juice, which means that before he even knew that the vineyard was really going to produce well, because not all vineyards do produce well, he was so confident that he actually created a yekev, a wine press, in order to collect all the good juices that he expected. Vayikav lasota navin, because he hoped, or he believed, that it would make grapes. Vayas beushim, but it made lousy grapes. Beushim are grapes that never ripen. Vata Yoshev Yushlaim, and now, O you dwellers of Jerusalem, verse 3. The Ish Yuda and people of Judah, Shiftu na beiniu bein karmi. And this is the singer singing for the friend of his who had the vineyard. And the friend is now saying, I want to go to Yushlaim, the capital city, and I want to tell you about the court case that I have against my vineyard. It's me against my vineyard. Ma lasot o bekarmi, what could I have done more to my vineyard? Velo asiti bo, that I did not do. Madua kiveti lasota rabim, why was I foolish? I'm adding in the word foolish. Why was I so silly to expect grapes? Vayas bushim, and all I got was the lousy grapes, the grapes that don't ripen. Vatau dianatchem et asher ani oseh lecharmi, and now I, the vineyard owner, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do to my carrot. Haser mesukato, I'm going to take away the protection. Sukkato is probably the wall protection around it. The hayala va'er, so that animals could come in and eat from the ground. I'm going to take away the stones that I'd set up in the beginning. Harots b'deiro, I'm going to knock down the fence. V'hayala mirma, so anybody could come and trample. All the animals could come and trample. Which means I, because my vineyard let me down, I'm going to break the protection around it so that all the animals can come in and smush and eat whatever they want. Va'ashiteyu vatan, I will leave it fallow, which means I'm not going to plant it next year. Lo yizamer v'lo yeader, it shall not be pruned, and it shall not be yeader, is probably some other kind of thing that you do to grapes or vineyards to organize that. Va'ala shamir v'shayit, and this is very critical, we're going to have to go back to this, because this is the key to all 12 chapters. And thorns, let's see how the briars and thorns will rise up in it. That is, because I'm not going to take good care of it, I'm not going to weed it, I'm not going to prune it, what will happen is briars and thorns will come up. And I will tell the clouds not to rain upon this vineyard. Now, all of a sudden, we're doing something which I could really spend a long time in, and I'm actually going to speak about it a little bit on Sunday in Torah Motion. All of a sudden, the metaphor is disappearing, and the referent is coming in, because up to this point, that last line, we were talking about a person. A person will decide to not prune his grapes. A person will decide to knock down his wall. But this last bit, which is, to the clouds I will command that they should not rain, all of a sudden, what are we seeing really? We're seeing the meaning behind the metaphor. What are we seeing there? That it's not man, it's not a farmer that could decide not to tell the clouds not to rain. It's only God that could do such a thing. So what's happening is that the metaphor is shifting out. We've been deep in metaphor up to this point. It's about a guy who's had a lousy time with his vineyard. That's all. And now he's going to destroy his vineyard. There's nothing supernatural about this whatsoever. But all of a sudden, this guy is going to command the rain not to come down, so the metaphor disappears, and we find out that God was the owner of the vineyard. And, of course, we could put the rest of it together, but we don't have to, because Yishayahu does it for us. Ki kerem Hashem tzvaot Beit Yisrael. Because the vineyard of God, the owner of the vineyard, and therefore, who's the vineyard? Vineyard is the house of Israel. The Ish Yehuda and Yehuda, Netash Shashuav, was the playful plantings, or the hopeful plantings. So essentially what Yishayahu is doing is now saying, okay, let's explain step by step what the metaphor is. I've told you it's God, and now I'm going to tell you that God's vineyard means the Jewish people. Vayikav l'mishpat, and what was he hoping for? What was he hoping that his vineyard would produce? What were the grapes? You understand? The Dodi, the beloved person, is God. The vineyard is Israel, north and south. The grapes that he was hoping that they would produce were mishpat, justice. And what actually came out were beushim, which was mispach, which was a play on the word. It means things that are ripped up or burnt apart. Staka, I was hoping for righteousness. The innate saka, and all I hear are screams. You notice the play on the words mishpat, mispach, and staka and saka. Saka of, we'll see, all of the poor people who have no justice whatsoever, and therefore they scream because they get no justice. So now, if you take a look at it, everything in the metaphor is explained except for one thing. And here I actually look at the board. Just go through the items and the images in the metaphor of the, insert yourself into the dreamland of the vineyard, and look at all the items that we went through in the vineyard, and then try to find its match in the real world. So what's the only thing that doesn't have a match? Kerem has the Jewish people. The Anavim have righteousness. The Beushim, the lousy grapes that never come up, have the unrighteousness. We could only guess that the singer who's singing for God is Yishayahu, by the way, that's the speaker. But there is one thing that's missing. What's missing? We never find out. What image is never given a definition? What's that? That's true. I didn't think about that. Yekev is not done, but actually I think Yekev, what do you think of Migdalis? It's never really told to us, but what are you saying to Migdalis? God builds a Migdal in the middle of the vineyard in order to watch over it. What would that most likely be? What would be the tower that was set up? What? No, the place where he would dwell to watch over. Where would that be? The Migdash, I think. Yekev, you're right, I'm not entirely sure. I never thought about it. I'm not entirely sure what the Yekev is. Maybe Yushalayim, the place where all the justice will flow. That's true, but I see something else that at face value, I have no idea what it is. It doesn't seem to have a metaphoric translation. Do you see anything else in there that has no translation? No, God's in there. God's the owner of the vineyard, or the owner of the vineyard is God. Anything in the dream imagery which has no translation in the real world? Just go through it, man. What verse are you in?
In the first verse.
The very first. Oh, Karen Ben Shaman. That's good. With the corner of Ben Shaman. So a lot of people say that would be for the Shaman is the Shaman Mishkat, the Ben Mikdash. It could be just a poetic niceness. You know, if Karen Ben Shaman actually sort of rhymes, or should Karen Ben Shaman. No, there's something really sort of, the borders around it become obvious. What are the stones around the borders? Those are the borders of Israel, being protected and not protected. And God removes his protection, and the bad guys come in. But there's one thing that's very strange. Take a look at verse 6. I shall leave it to Lezer, lo yizamer v'lo yader, ba'alah shamir v'shayit. What is that? There's no metaphoric translation for that whatsoever. We don't know what it means. But we do if we read all 12 chapters of the section. And that's, those are going to be the key words that when you look for them, only by reading all the way through 12 chapters will you actually find out who Shamir and Shayit are, because they are very real things. which are symbolized here as Shamir and Shayin. Something which causes destruction to Israel. And this is exactly what Shamir and Shayin is. Now, this, in chapter 5, sort of dead center in the middle of the 12 chapters. But some of the themes we're going to take a look at. One is the idea of mishpat and tzedakah, righteousness versus non-righteousness. Another thing is some kind of enemies will come and trample the vineyards. The Shamir and Shayin, I'll show you what that is later. So a lot of these themes we're going to see as we go through the book step by step, the first 12 chapters, and you'll see that they recur. So I'm going to save this so we can go back to it and see whether some of these issues were resolved. And it's a beautiful mashallah. And you could literally, if you wanted to focus on the mashallah Karen, we could really spend a long time with it. But I really want to try to cover it 12 chapters today. Okay. So we'll start what I think is in a good place with chapter 1. Let me just put this here. And here I have to remind you, we're going to start to build our structure. So the first thing I'd like to remind you of is the four kings. If you remember, Isaiah prophesied during the lifetime of four kings. One was Uzziahu / Azariahu, same name, same guy, known as two things, Azariahu. The second one was his son, Yotam, who, by the way, is never referenced in the book of Isaiah. He never talks to him at all. And I don't know if anybody remembers, I mentioned that Yotam ruled completely in his father's time. After his father, Uzziah, was struck with leprosy, he appointed Yotam as the working king, but essentially Uzziah outlived his son, Yotam. Then we have king number three, who is Ahaz, who was a very, very bad fellow, who worshipped the Avodah Zarah and did all kinds of nasty things. We met him in the first year, if you remember. He was the one that Yeshayahu came to and said, don't worry, you're not going to be overthrown by this guy Ben Tabal as long as you stick it out. But Uzziah was not a good guy. And finally, we have the famous Chizkiyahu, who led a religious reformation and was considered to be one of the kings that was almost the Messiah, was almost Mashiach. These are our four kings, and now we have to see where everything fits in. So, let's go to chapter 1. Chapter 1 actually is chapter 1 plus chapter 2, and it's right here. Chazon Yishayahu ben Amoz, Asher Chaza al Yudav Yishlayim. Now, don't forget the chapter system that we have is the Tzuchot, these little pays here, which indicate a full chapter break, and Samachs, which are Stumot, which indicate there's a pay, which means this is a full break. And this is a Samach, which is a minor break, which you can sort of feel because there's Lachain, therefore. The breaks that we have, chapter 1, chapter 2, were done by a Christian named Stephen Langton, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, also worked on the Magna Carta. So therefore, sometimes his chapter systems are really quite bad. And the harder the biblical text, the more mistakes Stephen Langton made. And here's a classic case, because the first true chapter, first prophecy of Isaiah, extends beyond chapter 1 into part of chapter 2. And what I'd like to point out for you is we don't know, we have no idea what time we're in. That is, we know that he prophesied for four kings. He prophesied for, let me use the highlighter, it's a little bit easier. He prophesied for these four kings, Uzziah, Yotam, Ahaz, and Chizkiyahu. But this first chapter, how do you identify it as far as time goes? Now, so what I'd like to point out is two major issues, and then the problem that the prophet is dealing with. There are two facts which allow us to pinpoint this prophecy in time. The first one is this. Okay. I'll read it. Artzechem shmama, your land is desolate. Arechem serufot esh, your territory is completely burnt up. Admatchem lenegdechem zarim ochlim ota, enemies have come to eat up your land. Ushmama kimapechat zarim, and it is desolate as if the enemies are leading an internal revolution of your own people. Vinotra batzion, and batzion, which is Jerusalem, is left alone kisuka becherem, like a lonely hut in the middle of a vineyard. There's our vineyard, by the way. Kimuna b'miksha, like a malon, like a little lean-to in a field of zucchini, of squash, kichurim. Ki'ir Mitzura, it is a isolated city. So what is the political, geopolitical state of Israel at this time? What is the political situation of the land of Judah at this time? What would you say? That is, if you were looking out at all of the lands of Judah, what would you say would be the condition of the lands of Judah? Destroyed. The only thing that remains is Jerusalem. It's the only thing that remains. What we also know, however, is we find out something interesting. We find out that people are really, really religious. Let me show you why. Because God says, as you come, let's read it. Lama li rov sivchechem? What are you bringing me all your sacrifices for, says God. Savati olot elim, I'm sick, I'm full of the sacrifices of your rams. The chelev, the fats of your fat rams. Vidam parim, and the blood of your cows. Kvasim v'atuvim lo chafatzi. I don't want it. What are you doing? I'm full of it. Ki tavo lera'ot panai, as you come to see my face. Mipikesh zot miyadchem, who asked you for this? Ramos chatzerai, oh you tramplers of my chatzer. Stop bringing all these false sacrifices. Your chodshechem, your rosh chodesh is it, and your morechem, and your cholamoids. Sana nafshi, I hate them, I hate when you come. Chodesh v'shabbat kero mikra, rosh chodesh shabbat, and the holidays, the shlosh regalim, alom chalam v'atzerai. How could you come with the sins to my palace? Ubefarishchem kapichem, and as you raise your hands up to pray to me, alim einai mikem. I'm not even looking at you. So, what is theoretically the religious, at least in practice, the religious situation, and what is the status of the temple at this time? What would you say? Temple exists, fully functional, and people are coming in loads. Not only are people coming in loads, people think that they're doing wonderful things. They really consider themselves very religious people. God is telling them that all of this is terrible. Why? Echa haita lezona, oh my city, look how, what a not prostitute really, but a stranger that you've become. Kiryat Ne'emana, the city that used to be believable, Maleati Mishpat, it used to be full of justice. Sedek Yalin Ba, righteousness used to be there. Batam Ratzachim, and now they're murderers. Now, they're not actually murderers. I don't have time to go into it, but what it means is that they are taking bribes in court cases, which very often leads to inappropriate deaths. But more likely, it's this. Sarayach Sorim, your officers are go against me. Chavrei Ganavim, all of your leaders are thieves. Kula Oheb Shoka, they all take bribes. Rodev Shalmonim, Shalmonim for L'Shalim, to pay off. They all like take payoffs. Yatom, the orphan, lo Yishpatu, they don't hear his court case. And they don't pay attention to widows because the widows and the orphans have no money to pay for good courts. So don't worry so much about the Ratzachim. They're not really murderers. And I'll just take my word for it now. I can prove it at another time. Essentially, because of the lack of Mishpat, Jerusalem is all that's left of the land of Judah. And the people inside of it, however, are really quite frum, and they go to shul every single day, and God is telling them that all of their prayers and all of their sacrifices are worthless because of the lack of justice. And these are things that you probably remember from the Keren. Now, there's only one king which satisfies these things. We have a disastrous economic, political situation, but a very good religious situation. Well, Uzziah Azariah, I don't know if you remember from last time, he was a very powerful king who controlled all of Israel, and he had no problem with wars. In fact, he had a massive standing army, which we'll get into. Which means, can't be Uzziah by process of deduction. Yotam, he never speaks to, because Yotam doesn't really independent. Ahaz, it can't be, because Ahaz is an idol worshiper. People are not coming. He's closed down the temple for that service. Which leaves you only Chizkiyahu, which means the first prophecy of the book starts with Chizkiyahu, because this is what happened. Chizkiyahu rules for 9 years. I'm sorry, Chizkiyahu rules coin to top for 14 years. And in comes the king of Ashur, Sennacherib, and destroys all of Judah. Israel, he's already taken rid of. Ashur is already exiled some 10 years before that. He comes, he destroys every single city that exists. and leaves only one Jerusalem, and then a miracle happens, the angels come out and fight against the forces of Ashur, Sennacherib, King Sennacherib, runs back home, and he's killed sometime later by his own kids in a palace court. But essentially, the situation only matches Chizkiyahu's time, which means there is no money. Sorry. There seems to be religion, but there's a lack of civil justice. And then you have to say to yourself, well, why does the book start off with that? Why do I start off there? So, but of course, we already know the book is out of order because we found out last week that the opening prophecy where he got his job is already in chapter 6. So it shouldn't surprise us that the book was out of order. But just because you identified that the book was chronologically out of order means you have to find out why it's chronologically out of order. So now let's go to chapter 2. Let me see if I can pull this off. I'm trying to run. I think I can do this. Okay. Chapter. Let me just see if I got everything. I'm sorry. I have another file with my answers in. So I just want to open it up and make sure I covered all my bases. Item number 2. What we're skipping at the bottom of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2 is this famous prophecy about how all the people will come to Jerusalem and everybody will recognize God, etc., etc. And that's interesting, but it's not going to affect the flow of the book right now, so we're going to move over until essentially what should have been the beginning of chapter 2. So let me read it to you. What we have... am I in the right place? If you take a look at this text, there's an idea called the Milat Mantra. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea. Milat Mantra is words that repeat themselves over and over and guide the understanding of the chapter. So I would ask you, if you could take a look at this chapter 2 that you have in front of you, what do you see? What's that?
Milat.
Where? Tell me where and which verses.
I saw the second line and the second line.
Phil,
there's one in the first line.
Line, and there's one in the middle of the third line, and the end of the third line. There's one 3 words away from the end of the second line. That is very nice. I never saw that before. Okay, let's leave it up the board and see what we can make out of it. Are there any others? Alright. Do you see any others that ideas that repeat themselves over and over again? Now, some of the words, I must admit, are difficult. So I'll help you out. Shaf means to lower, to bring down from on high. So I guess I'm sort of feeding you the answer. That was really fair of me. But let me do one of my Milat Mantra that I notice. Vayishaf Adam, a man will be brought low. And then Yishbal Ish, a man will be lowered.
Do you mind dropping in the highlighting a little bit?
Yeah, it's not good enough. Okay, let me try this one.
It may just be me.
Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Do you see any other words which indicate low? Actually, shafel, shach. Any other ones?
Shafel.
Okay. Any others?
Shafel.
I have this one. Did you find one beforehand?
Well, there's the reference to height. Are we counting those two?
Well, that's exactly it. I'll get to the height in a second. Right now, I want to get the low. Any others? Okay. I think that's it. Now let's do high. Go ahead. Where do you see the word? Where do you see high, Leah?
Well, I've lost it now.
Well, start from the beginning. Gavut, Gavoa. I'm going to translate all this stuff in a second. Right now, I just want to get the highs and the lows. Rum, Anashim, the height of man. Then this God, and God will be lifted up. What did I say?
Next line.
Next line?
And the next one.
called Ge'er, which means proud, Viram, and Nisa means carried up, and so does Tisa.
I mean,
the end of one that I'm on, if you want to figure it. Right. And Nisaim, and the high ones. Harim Haramim, the mighty mountains. Va'ot HaNisa'ot, the raised up hills. Migdal Gavoha, the high towers. Let's see. Gavut HaAdam, the ego, or the full of oneself. Rum Anashim, V'nizgav, will be raised up, God by himself. Any others? Yeah, because it's sort of like a phrase, it's like a together phrase. And you'll see why, what will happen. So here we have, now, I agree, Malu definitely has its place, but the idea of the high being brought low is, that's what I would say is the theme here. The high is brought down low. And God goes high. And now I'll translate a little bit. The Tamale, by the way, what's happening here is that people are turning to false gods. People are turning to something else besides God to help them out. We'll see what that is. I'm going to get to in a second. We'll see what those false gods are. But man will be brought down and the people will be lowered and God will not raise them up. And they will hide in the dirt. And the enei gavut adam, the truth is I should have included the word enei, the eyes of people, you know, like people have their eyes up in the air, like their chins up in the air today, you would say. Shafel bashach, God will lower them up. And rum anashim, and the heights of man will be, I'm sorry, bashach rum anashim, the heights of man will be lowered. As opposed to that, then is gav Hashem levado v'yamahu, God himself will be raised up. And it's not only man, though. Al arzei halbanon haramim v'anasaim, the great cedars of Lebanon that are so high, they'll be brought down, or at least everything will be known from that height. And on the Harim Aramim, and all the Gvod Yisod, and all the high mountains, and all the high hills, V'akol Migdal Gavon, on every high hill, V'akol Chomah V'surah, V'akol Niyot Tashish, and Fantasies, V'shach Kavut Adam, V'shafel Ruma Anashim, V'nizgav Hashem V'yomahu. So that's really the theme which runs through this entire chapter, and chapter 3, which I'm going to get to in a second. This little section has man crawling through rocks, bending down, worshiping bats, which really means that they're in caves and the bats are flying over their heads. And because they're running away and they're hiding in caves from the oncoming enemies, they are on their hands and knees to the bats, essentially, is what's happening here. But that's the theme of this whole section. What was once high, what is now low. Which means that if you're going to deliver this message to people, does it make sense that that message would be delivered during Chizkiyahu's time? Would you say yes or would you say no? And can you justify your answer? If the message here is everything you know about it, the haughtiness of man, how proud you are, and everything that you do, all of that is going to be brought down and only God will be recognized at that time. So, would you put that in Chizkiyahu's time? Why would you?
That's just that they're being
so their attitude is...
Right, okay, go ahead.
So they should be corrected.
So you're translating Gavhut as sort of like a personal, spiritual, religious self-confidence, mm-hmm. and that God will show them what it's all about. That's possible. That's certainly possible. But Migdal, when you say Migdal, I'll call Migdal Gavoa on every big thing, every great cedar tree. I get the sense of a physical, of a financial wealth. That is, people aren't usually egotistical about how friendly they are. Actually, people are kind of egotistical about how friendly they are. That's true. That's true. Yeah, now they certainly do. Yeah, that's true. Maybe back then they were a bit better. But what people very often get egotistical about is their wealth. And if we go with what I'm saying, and I realize that I sort of like rejected what you said in order to give you my idea, and that's not really a great way to teach, but I'll show you another reason why I think there may be an issue here that it's not during Chizkiyahu's time. You know what? There's nothing that makes my answer that it's a physical wealth better than your answer, which is that it's a spiritual wealth, unless I try to show that they were some other verse that shows that they were physically wealthy. So now let me see if I can back up my proof, because otherwise my argument is not solid. Let me go to, just a second. Oh, where's the file? Not just a second. Let me go to this verse in chapter in verse 2 right here. Your timale verse, your thing of the land is filled with something. But timale artso and his land, we don't know who his is because there's no king mentioned here. We don't know what time period it is. One assumption was it's the same one as the previous one. My last chapter was about Hezekiah, his doubt, and this one is also. Timale artso elivim lemasei adav yishtachahu lasher asu etzvotah, which means the land was filled with elilim. With elilim, how would you translate elilim? False gods, that's what it seems to be. Lemasei adav yishtachahu, they bow down to the things that their hands make. Lasher asu etzvotah, that's which their fingers have constructed. So first of all, that makes it a little bit difficult. The simple read makes it a little bit difficult to be in Chizkiyahu's time. Because Chizkiyahu's time was not, they didn't have a problem with idol worship. They were worshiping God. Here it's saying that the entire land was filled up with these elilim, which are, at simple translation, they are idols. So that creates a little bit of problem on the Chizkiyahu theory. But there's something else very interesting, by the way. And what I'd like to do is I'd like you to notice these two phrases, Yadav and Etzvotav. It shows up not too many times in the rest of Tanakh, but I'll show you one time that it does show up in Tanakh, and I think it gives us a clue to what is happening here. So let me take you to Tehillim, or Psalms, 100 and where's Psalms? Tehillim? 144. And there's a very little known psalm because it's right before Tehillah LeDavid that everybody knows. It's not in any of our prayers, but it's really quite interesting. LeDavid, a psalm of David. Baruch Hashem Tzuri, blessed be God, my rock. Hamalamed Yadai Likrav, who teaches my hands to battle. Etzvaotai, Lamilchama, and my fingers, he teaches them how to prepare for war. So here we have the double phrase of Yadai and Etzvaotai, but it's not referring to, that is, it's not referring to idols, it's referring to battle things that I hold in my hands. Why is that important? Because one of our other kings, interestingly enough, let me take you to him. One of our other kings was a king named Uzziah. And let me show you a little bit about Uzziah. Let me stretch this out a bit. And we'll read a little bit about Uzziah. This is not your handouts. I cheated. I don't know why, but I did. Vayhi Uzziah chayal osei milchama. Uzziah had a powerful army of warriors. Yotzei tzava l'gdud. They were organized. Uzziah had done something that really hadn't been done since Solomon's time. Normally, when you had a battle, so what you did was then you sent word out to all of your farmers, and you asked them to bring whatever weapons they had in the battle. King Solomon held organized troops, and so does Uzziah, which is really kind of a new idea. Assyria was doing it, but in Israel, they were pretty much, you know, farmers, peacemakers, and whenever you have to fight, you fight. The idea of a standing army, it was not common, but he made a standing army. The Mispar Kudotam Yad Yel HaSofer, so Sofer was in charge of the army. So there were three people charged out. Kol mispar she'avot v'dibore chayil alpayim b'sheshmio, which means there were 2,600 officers. 2,600 officers. Va'al yadam, and on their hands, chayil tzava shloshmio t'elef u'shvat alafim chameshmio. That is standing army of 300, 7,000, 307,500. For ancient times, it's a huge army. That's over a quarter of a million standing active duty soldiers. These are Chayal Kravi. And the Shivat Elafim, Osei Milchama, Bechol Chayal. They knew every form of war, Lazor, La Melech, Aloyev, to constantly battle, which is why Uzziah was so successful. He owned massive amounts of land because he was a very powerful leader. Vayachan and Uzziah, the Chol Tzava Maginim. They were an equipped army. They had shields and machim, and they had spears, the kovaim, and they all 300,000 spears, 300,000 shields, 300,000. Oh no! Prayers in the service. That's where we received this first prophecy. Sort of makes sense that you're rolling into Uzziah's time. What doesn't make sense is why you open. If what I'm saying is true. Well, thank you. If what I'm saying is true, here, let me see if we have it towards the end. Well, there are all kinds of other things. Armor, shatot, or bows and arrows, avnei klaim. This was an extremely well-equipped army. They had every piece of gold and silver around that you could imagine, putting together their army. He made migdalim, giant towers. Remember that word from Kol Migdal Gavoa? Came up with all these ideas of migdalim with little places where you could shoot arrows from. And then it says, Ubechez kato, and as he became so chazak, gavach nibo, his heart was raised up, and he had a haughty heart. Ad l'hashchit, b'yimal b'hashem, and then he went against God, and he went into the temple in order to do sacrifices on the temple, and that's where Yishayahu starts to get his job, and that's where God gives him leprosy. He's got leprosy, and he's thrown out of his rulership, even though he's still alive. I believe this gavah matches the gavah that we have, I believe. I mean, I can't prove it. I believe that that's what we're talking about here. Let me go back to it. I think that the Ruma and the Enei Gavut Adam, you see how that matches? And I claiming that Elilim L'Masei Adav Yishtakavu L'Asher Asai Etzvotav is not idols in the simplistic sense. Because it doesn't fit, the truth is it doesn't fit Uzziah's time. And it doesn't fit Chizkiyahu's time. Because Chizkiyahu was a prim guy. And Uzziahu also wouldn't have had a Avodah Zarah. So you'd have to say, if this is really Avodah Zarah, then there's only one king that could actually fit into. Which king would that fit into if it was really Avodah Zarah? Remember, which was our Avodah Zarah king of our four? We have Uzziahu, Yotam, Achaz, and
Achaz.
So it only fits Achaz. No problem, nothing else really matches at all. So, to my mind, that's what we're talking about. And now what I'd like to do is I'd like to go on to chapter 3. And what you're going to see is that, let me see what I wanted to highlight. Yeah, okay. Here again, in chapter 3, what we have in the first section is that God is going to take away from Yehuda all mashana, all that supports this ministry will be taken away. Why? Because Jerusalem has failed, and Yehuda has fallen. Again, this idea of fallen. And then it says, Vayomer Hashem, Yan ki gafu benot Zion. There again, we have that word, gafu benot Zion. And what we have is this long passage about how they're all dressing up too fancy, and they go walking around with clappers and all kinds of strange things. And I don't want to get into that strange prophecy, because it seems like the most anti-feminist prophecy in all of the Bible, if not all of the literature of the time. And he seems to go into these women who are haughty, they're dressed in fancy clothes, and they're walking around. And I'll show it another time, is those aren't women at all. That's talking about Jerusalem itself being too haughty. And then finally, what we have is this pasuk here. V'haya ha-nish'ar v'tzion v'anotar v'yushalayim kadosh y'ar me'lo kol katub l'chayim v'yushalayim. This idea is very important. So essentially, what happens is support is removed. That is, there's a support system that's taken away. God says, why? Because of your ego. Yan ki gavu benot Zion, which I would not translate as really women, but in general. And then afterwards, hi, good evening. And then afterwards, God is going to come down And the woman, if they're really women, which I don't think they are going to be so desperate because there's going to be no people. On that day, they're going to essentially throw themselves at the men under any circumstance because there won't be enough men for seven, that is, there'll only be one man for seven women to get around, which means a total decimation of the male population. And then finally, it ends off with this idea of, but those who remain in Jerusalem, they will be called Kodesh, and they will be written down in the Book of Life. So what you essentially have is something called a Shar Yashub, which is Israel, the males are depopulated from Jerusalem. What's that? Because of huge... Well, what happens is we're going to find out that depopulation only happens when some Sancheirib comes. And that's where I want to show that connection. That is, what I'm claiming, and I'll go back to the first page in a second, is that the prophecy opens up... Let me go to a new page. Here's what I'm claiming. The prophecy opens up in Hezekiah's time, with Hezekiah. It then moves very quick, and the problem seems to be no justice. Right? That's what was really written in chapter 1. I'm claiming that it moves backwards in time to the beginning, back about 80 years, to Uzziah's time, where the problem was no justice. There was plenty of justice. What was the, where people were so, the truth is, they were so rich nobody cared about justice because there weren't too many, you told me even Amana, there was plenty of money to go around. If you could afford to put together an army of 350,000 standing troops who are fully equipped, fully battle ready, fully armored, etc., and build all kinds of towers in the desert, money is not your problem. Very often justice is your problem because who's complaining? There's plenty of money to go around for everybody. The problem with Uzziah was the ego, the fact that they were worshiping their weapons. That's my claim. That's my claim. Then Uzziah, there's this prophecy that the destruction will come. And what will happen during the destruction is few will remain. And these few are called the Shar Yashuv, the few who are left to return. But this destruction doesn't take place until Chizkiyahu's time. Which means, it's Uzziah's sin, which starts the ball rolling, but it's not until Chizkiyahu's time that the destruction actually takes place. And I'll try to show you that by going through these 12 chapters. That's, again, just to go again, the first chapter only matches Chizkiyahu's time because only Jerusalem is left and yet the people are from. That's Chizkiyahu. In the second and third chapter, there's a good support system which God is saying I'm going to tear down. There seems to be money. There seems to be a major gavu problem. Gavu. And I'm claiming that the idols were the army. And by the way, I don't like to get, what's the word when one thinks that they can interpret anything in the Bible to what happens today? I'm fundamentalistic. I do not like to be a fundamentalist. But the idea that a country will put all of its belief systems into a standing army and then that becomes their savior is a problem, honestly, that we have today. In fact, people always say to me, Rabbi Levi, is it really true that you believe that the Israeli army protects the land of Israel? Because what people who ask me that question are waiting for me to say yes, and therefore I'm an idol worshiper. I don't know if you have you ever had that experience? I have a very simple answer. Yes, the Israeli army protects the land of Israel. And God protects the Israeli army. So it's an easy way to get out of it. But there's no doubt that the feeling is that if you believe that the army protects the land of Israel, you therefore don't believe that God protects the land of Israel, i.e. you are an idol worshiper. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in chapter 2 and chapter 3. And how do we know that Uzziah didn't really think that he believed he was more powerful than God, so to speak? Because as soon as he became the most powerful dude with the hottest army, the most powerful land, the unquestioned guy, what's the first thing he did that he wanted, what he was really, his first response to that was, I'm going to go into the temple and I'll tell God how I'm going to do the worship. And that's the Avodah Zarah. How do we know that's Avodah Zarah? Because remember, who was the first two people who did Avodah Zarah and died for it? But God forbid that we should think that they were worshiping idols, real idols. Nadav and Abihu. Nadav and Abihu did Avodah Zarah. But just because they worship Avodah Zarah does not mean they were worshiping Avodat Elilim. Here what I'm saying is actually uses the word Elilim. Nadav and Abihu were the two first sons of Aaron. And they went in. And we never know what they did exactly. But whatever it is, and they were in the temple, in the tabernacle, they were there to worship God. But they did something the wrong way. Maybe they were drunk, maybe they read it on the wrong day. Whatever it was, they died for their sins. It was an avodah zarah. It said specifically. And yet they were not idol worshippers. So you have this idea where if you don't believe in God, another reflection of not believing in God is not so much not believing Him per se and believing in the Baal or Zeus, but it's believing that you control the religion and not God controls religion. You control the protection of the land, not God. I believe in God. He's a nice guy. But what's protecting my country? I'll tell you what's protecting my country. My sword, my sword, my arrows, my spears, my 350,000 men. So that's what we've moved to in chapter 2 and chapter 3. Am I good on time? I think I can do this. Man. No. Okay. So, step by step, we start with his doubt, we go to Uzziah's ego problem, and at the end of that large prophecy, and by the way, another mistake by our friend, Christian friend Stephen Langton, it should not have been chapter 2 and chapter 3. It's the end of chapter 2 and chapter 3 are clearly one prophecy, because the word Gavhu shows up over and over, and the idea of God bringing down the haughty shows up over and over. They're really one extended prophecy. Which brings us, of course, to chapter... Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry, and chapter 4. And look what he did, by the way. This is what he did with chapter 4, which makes no sense, because here he's talking about these women. These are the women, Yan Kigavu Benot Zion, because the daughters of Zion have become haughty, because they dress up too fancy, and they wear all kinds of makeup, etc., etc. Now, again, what I'm saying to you, and it's actually something I'm going to be speaking about on Sunday, about how to understand metaphor, what I'm saying to you is these are not real women. These are the entire population. This is Jerusalem herself, personified as women. She's so egotistical, she thinks that she's haughty, she can do whatever she wants, she puts her necklaces in Shir HaShirim. It's the opposite. In Shir HaShirim, we hear of the girl with the long neck, with the necklaces around her neck, and that's a representation of the shields that Uzziah set up around, or Shlomo himself set up around the walls of Jerusalem. Here we have the opposite. We have a description of women with shields with a necklace all around. And what I'm saying, and I'd ask you to believe me, because it takes a while to prove, is that we're not talking about women here at all. And then here we have the idea of Shar Yashuv. So, and then here we continue with the woman. Seven women will try to find a single person in that day. And they'll say, listen, we're going to serve you just because there's nobody left to serve. And then we have the Shar Yashuv. So again, this is all one prophecy, which I'm claiming is all in the time of Uzziah, and has to do with the knocking down of the support system. And that's what's happening here. I will take out all of the supports out of Jerusalem. That means that there was supports, powerful supports, and God is going to knock all those supports down. And that's why I want to say that it's not the time of Hezekiah, it's the time who was poor but religious, but the time of Uzziah, who was rich, in a sense religious, but really worshipped himself more than anything else, and therefore became an idol worshiper per se. And the Rav has said this. He said, you know, don't think that idol where you can worship money. Money can be your, you know, they say instead of gold, God we trust on the American dollar. It should say in gold we trust on the American dollar. And that's really not being metaphoristic. People worship anything other than God, meaning they believe something else will save them, and that is idol worship in and of itself. Okay. And now we're... Yes. I'm sorry, go ahead. Please.
Just about the style.
Yes.
Why so many sense of who
Isaiah was? Yes, and somebody that we spoke about before, he was an extremely literate person. The puns here, the play on words, the connections he'll make. He teases you with...
Why can't he just come out and just say it? Right? Why is he using metaphor?
That goes to the issue of prophecy. And that goes back to some very dangerous territory, and I don't want to be thrown out of the city too fast. I have 6 more months left. I don't want anybody to throw me out of the city. But prophets were not like Moses. Even Isaiah, who was considered to be a top-notch prophet, much more powerful than Yahweh and his... That's what they say. They say that Yeshayahu was the Ben Prophet. He was the person who... Well, that is, they compare him against Hizkiyahu. Not Hizkiyahu. Who's the prophet? Yechezkel. That he was powerful in his ability to perceive and understand God. They say that Yeshayahu, essentially, when he saw the images, the reason why these images of these burning angels are really quite simple and they don't go into detail like Yechezkel, is because Yechezkel was amazed at what he saw. He's never seen anything like it before. But Yeshayahu, our Yeshayahu, was apparently so in tune with God's thinking that, you know, he gave a quick description and that was enough. That's how the rabbis understand him, is being really very closely... if you have a like a let's say I have a spectrum of people who really understand exactly what God is meaning to them, which would be Moshe. Moshe kind of understands word for word what God wants to say. And then on the far end you have Daniel, who understood so little that he had no idea what he was seeing, and he had to ask Gabriel, the angel, to come explain it to him. Take a look at the end of Daniel. So Daniel has this prophecy, and he goes, I have no idea what it is. So God sent the angel Gabriel to come and explain to him, oh, this means that, this means that, this means that, which means, I'm not saying that Daniel wasn't a great guy, he was a great guy, but there are radios that are extremely in tune to God's message, and the radios that there's a lot of static. So the reason why people talk in mashal, to answer your questions, first of all, they may not completely, they may be hedging his bets. I'm going to get to the issue of the lamb lying down with the lion. So there are two opinions about that. According to the Kabbalistic mystical opinion, that is, the world will really change in the times of the Messiah, of Mashiach, and that it will be, like, the whole world nature will change, and lambs will, and lions will both be herbivores, and they literally lie down together. According to the Rambam, according to Maimonides and many others, that's just a metaphor. The lamb is the state of Israel. The lions are the states around Israel. And metaphorically speaking, they will live together in peace. So one of my students says, why not just say which one it is and you solve the problem? And I said, it could be Yishayahu, didn't know. Yishayahu received the prophecy in image form. But he may not have known whether it was actually a metaphor or whether it was literal. It's mystical, then literal, it's the animals lying down with each other without eating each other. If it's a metaphor, then it's the nations, but the image he receives from God is always in images. No prophet except for Moses saw prophecy directly. It says that in Sefer Bamidbar. Every other prophet sees prophecy in dreams, in images, in chidot is the word, in riddles. Because even Yishayahu was a powerful prophet and a learned man and a beautiful poet. An immense scribe, and by the way, wait till he speaks Assyrian. He speaks Assyrian. He was such a guy who was in tune with politics that he spoke the language of the enemy. He was the top of the top. Even he cannot directly see what God sent him. And therefore, I believe that partially it's that they're receiving images and not literal text. And therefore, they're not going to take a chance of saying, oh, I know what that means. That means Israel is going to be at peace with their neighbors, because they themselves are not sure whether the image is a direct meaning or a literal text. The perfect example is Jeremiah. The first possible prophecy of Jeremiah is, what do you see, Jeremiah? And Jeremiah says, Yirmiyahu says, I see a bubbling pot open to the north. And God says, good that you saw that. And I'll tell you what that means. That means the enemy is going to come from the north. But he had to be told that. He also says that actually the first image was not that. The first image was Makel Shakeda he wrote at. I see a staff with almonds growing from it. And God says, you saw it very nicely. What that means, Jeremiah, is that I am going to quickly, just like a almonds grow quickly, my wrath is going to come quickly too. What that means is he saw the metaphor clearly. God checked that he saw the metaphor. But he did not know whether it was a literal translation. And God said, it's not literally a staff, which I'm going to drop on your head out of the skies. The staff represents, metaphorically, this. But when Yishayahu sees the lamb lying down with the lion, if he knew whether it was literal, if you take it literally, or he knew whether it was a metaphoric image that would have to be translated into the nations when they put together, he never lets us in. I don't know why, but he doesn't let us in. Maybe because he knew what that we would assume it was a metaphor. Or maybe he knew we were going to assume that it was a mystical experience in the times of Mashiach and the world will change. Or maybe that he wasn't sure whether it was mystical or not mystical. Or maybe because it's both. Maybe God hasn't made up his mind that whether Mashiach is going to be coming in natural form, and then lions will still eat lambs, but nations won't fight against each other. Or God will bring the messianic days in mystical ways, and therefore all nature will change, and lions will no longer eat lambs. Maybe God hasn't made up his mind, and therefore Isaiah has left it in metaphor.
Do you see what I'm saying?
That said, a few classes ago, that prophets have insight. You know,
they saw, and then they
advise
the kings.
Yes, that's in a case where they're looking at an earthquake, and then all of a sudden they see the mystical experience that it's really mean on a spiritual existence. But here, there is no physical existence, really. God just says, in the future, this is how it's going to look. So the prophet in that case is not seeing something that's right in front. He's not seeing the mystical translation of what he's saying. He's not saying, oh, that's an earthquake. But what does it really mean? God says, I will tell you what it means. It means that my kavod is spread out because of this guy who was Yahweh who dares to go against me, etc., etc. Here he's saying in the future, the lion will lie down with the lambs. He has no real experience to know whether it's a... He has no translation layer. He has only the metaphor. He doesn't know whether the metaphor represents a translation or whether it represents itself. It needs to be taken literally. So it's a little bit different that these two are different prophetic experiences. One is here's what's happening now, and the other one is here's what's going to be in the future. Also, I'd like to say that a poet expresses himself in poetry because he allows the reader to derive multiple meanings. When a poet writes a beautiful poetry, you can say the same thing about a modern poet. Why don't you say what you mean? If you love her, if she has pretty eyes, so stop saying, I drowned in the pools of her. Just say she had pretty eyes.
No, no,
because
yeah,
I can create
a
sense of...
a poet, but I wasn't looking at him as a poet.
He's a poet. He is. He's all... Prophets are also poets. They express themselves in ways that, I believe, that allow the reader to derive multiple meanings of text. And that's the beauty of it. He's able to say 70 things by saying only very few words. And that's a powerful book. Because he is a poet. Then there's no doubt that this is unbelievable poetry. I'll show you a little bit here and there. And that line above in the previous chapter where he talks about hands and fingers, he's quoting from David. King David, who's also a poet. I believe he's quoting from him. Let me continue on to the next chapter and we'll follow through the flow of the story. Chapter 5. Okay. Chapter 5 started off with Mashal HaKeren. And we're skipping that now because we started off with Mashal HaKeren. Here we have a very long thing. We can't read through the whole thing, but I want you to notice if you see a word that repeats itself over and over. Does everybody see it? It's at the beginning of about 6 sentences. No, I'll give it away just so I can go a little more quickly. Look for the green surrounded by gray. Hoi. 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 Hoi, hoi, hoi. And after two hoys, we have this response. Because of what I'm hoying about, hoy, according to the translation, there are two interpretations of hoy. Hoy can be called to you, like oi, like in English, where they say oi. I remember there was this funny scene in, what was the name of that movie with Colin Firth, but the modern movie, the more modern movie with the girl who squints a lot. That's the girl who squints a lot, the actress who squints a lot. We just saw her in this podcast.
I think Sick Weather is dying of
Virginia. And she can't get their attention. She's like doing this, like, you see the movie? She's trying to get the attention of the crowd. And she stands up there, she can't get there, she goes, oi! And they're all quiet, but they're shocked because it's not what one does in literary circles. So hoi could be oi, the English oi, or it could be oi vei, the Yiddish oi vei. The Targum, the translation, the Arabic translation, believes that it's an oi, God saying, oh God. That whoever he's oi-ing to is not being addressed directly, that they are being addressed about, they're being spoken about. Point to Ibn Ezra, he believes that Hoy is a call to these people to stop doing what they're doing. But again, that's if we really wanted to delve into chapter 5, I'm just trying to give you a basic idea. So, the first one is people who build their houses so big that there's no room in the middle for poor people or to spread out. What I call the McMansion syndrome, which you find in a lot of religious neighborhoods where they build these gigantic houses right up to the line. And then we have a friend, actually, who has this kind of regular-sized house, and everybody around him is building these gigantic houses right up to the property line.
Let me stress, not in Toronto.
Not Toronto. Not Toronto.
It's a different city.
And the people who don't have the money to build their big house, they can't see out their windows anymore. They used to be able to see the sky, and now they see these gigantic brick walls. They're like, you ever see these gigantic McMansions? What's funny is, because big houses are a modern-day type, and what's interesting to notice is that they're an ancient type. Rich people are building these gigantic estates, leaving no room and property for poor people to build anything. They're completely dominating the market. It's the first point. I mean, you could do a whole pulpit. I mean, this is great pulpit stuff, if you put it from us, but it's not in any Haftorah, so nobody ever does it. But man, oh man, if I wanted to be fundamentalist, I would just say, let's take a look here. And there's all kinds of fundamentalist stuff. Here are my drinkers. Yayin Yad Likain, it's wine that lights them up. And because of these two sins, look what we have. You see, we're back to the same, we're in the same prophecy. Vayishach Adam Yishpal Ish. This is a throwback to our previous, which means even though up here is Mashal HaKeren, don't be fooled by Mashal HaKeren. That's not an interruption. Mashal HaKeren is a hinge which the prophecy on both sides relates to. We're still in Uzziah's time, if you buy my theory that chapter 3 and 4 are the end of 2 and 3 and 4, all about how man is haughty and loves his wealth and riches, and God's going to bring that down. We're into the same language. Vohim tishvala vayikba Hashem v'dishvat v'ha'el ha'kadosh. You recognize these lines, right? V'ha'el ha'kadosh mikdash v'tzdaka. But look what's happened now. We've combined two ideas. What was the problem by Chizkiyahu's time, which was chapter 1? They were from people. They didn't have an ego problem as far as we could tell. They just had no money and nothing left except for just Jerusalem because the enemy was all about them. They had their religion, but their religion was not as firm as they thought. What they really didn't have was their lack of justice. Remember that from chapter 1? In the Uzziah crooking from two to four up to this point, it was all about ego. We didn't see that there was a lack of justice. It was the sense of idol worship, that I love my money and I love my warfare and I love my gigantic buildings and God's going to take all of them down. And now the two are combined together. Right? In the previous one, it just said, "Nisgav Hashem Vado," God will be raised up. But now it's different. "Va'yikva Hashem Tzvaot b'mishpat va'el hakadosh mikdash b'tzdaka," which now integrates the first chapter. Do you see what I'm saying? Let me go back to this. So here we have a warning of the destruction. Now we have a continuation of the same prophecy after Mashal HaKerem, after the vineyard story. Continuation. Where we have the ego problem, but it throws back again to the no justice problem. So literally, it's actually beautiful if you have the patience to read it all through and look for the connecting words. In chapter 5, after the Mashal HaKerem, what the prophet is doing now is linking the two primary problems. One, the lack of justice of Chizkiyahu's time, and two, the ego problem of Uzziah's time. The question is, but wait a second, they're two different times, they're two different problems. Why are you linking it together? They're two different sins. Why are you integrating the two together? And that's something we're going to have to solve, and we'll be able to solve that by continuing on. That's the question the reader is asking. What's my problem here? Ego or lack of justice? Is it the haughtiness or is it the fact that the poor can't get a break? I'm confused. At this point, where we are now, in the middle of chapter 5, I don't understand what the problem is. Tell me what the problem is. Gvohim tishvana, or vayikva shem tzvot mishvat vayel ha-kadosh mitash mitzaka. Which is it? Now we have more hoys. And I love this. Hoy ha-omim l'ra tov v'la tov ra. Samim choshech l'or v'or l'choshech samim mar l'matok matok l'mar. Oy to those who say that good is bad and that bad is good, who make dark that which is light and say light that which is dark, who say sweet is bitter and bitter is sweet. And that's like half the politicians of the world today. You hear this all around. Those Israelis, they're doing it. Israelis are an apartheid state. Anybody who agrees with that is choshech l'or and or l'choshech. The idea that if I lie about something enough, it becomes true. This psyche of, you know how I'm going to count on my problem? You're telling me that this is bad. I'm going to tell you, O prophet, or anybody else complaining, that actually it's great. But we have a standing army, 350,000 people. You're telling me that I got an ego problem? You know, look at me. This is the power of God. This is light, not darkness. And that's what's going on. It's a beautiful hoy. And then there is another hoy, which is, and here we get back into the issue, matzdikei rasha ikev shocha, those who take bribes to affect court cases. So again, here we have an integration of the ego of Uzziah's time and the lack of justice of the corrupt court systems of Chizkiyahu's time. And then we have another lachem, and here's where it all turns around. And watch what happens. Does anybody see anything? This is where you have to know grammar. Lachem te'chol kash lashon esh, just like a straw is eaten up by fire. V'chashash lehava yirpeh, and a chashash, some kind of grass, the flames will weaken. Shorsham kemakiyeh, their roots, that is the Jewish people, their roots will be like dust, burnt away like dust. I'm going to skip along. Ki ma'asu et Torah Hashem, because they found the Torah of God disgusting. Yet in Rat Kadosh Yisrael Mietzu. Al-Kain, now look what happens here, and it's cut off a little bit, so I suggest you're looking at it in your text. Al-Kain, chara af Hashem. What tense is chara? Future or past?
past. Now let's read on. Chara af Hashem amo, vayet yado. Now here's trickier. Vayet. Does that mean he will stretch out his hand, or he has stretched out his hand? It's past. It's vayipuch. Yet means will stretch out. Vayet is like vayomer, past tense. And he has stretched out his hand. Vayakehu, and he has hit them. Which means the prophet who's talking, in my opinion, in the times of Uzziah, has said that God has punished them. And what are the next two words after that? Vayirgezu ha'arim. What does vayirgezu ha'arim mean? And there was an earthquake. You see how beautifully it ties in? God has already done this. The prophet is now prophesizing. He's seen what happened in the temple. That was his first mission. And now he comes out to tell him, yeah, I'll tell you what you did wrong. It wasn't that you walked into the temple. That was a byproduct of your problem. Your problem is a standing army of 350,000 people. Your problem is that people don't go to shul. They don't need to because they need to go to basic training instead. And they don't pray to God before they take on the enemies. They look at their sword, and they give it a good kiss, and they go into battle. Which is a common army problem. And what he's saying is God has already done this. Do you see how beautiful it is if you catch the grammar right? But, here's the bad news. Bechol zot, I'm going to highlight this in yellow because it's critical. Bechol zot lo shava po od yadon tuya. And even though I sent this earthly, the chol zot lo shav hapo, his anger is not quenched. The od zro'o mituya, which means his arm is still stretched out, which means, what does it mean? How would you translate that?
There's
more to come. You follow what's going on? You see that? I knocked down the mountains. I shook you up. And it's obviously not enough. And that's what this is saying. It's unbelievable. Where is it? The cholzo, and it's scary. The cholzo boshava kov odiaton tuya, and now you can find out what does come. That's what I underline in blue. Yine mehira kal yavo. I'm going to call to an enemy. I'm going to scream to an enemy. This is Asher, by the way, although he never names him. And look what he says about this enemy. Ein ayef ve'ein koshel. Lo yanum ve'lo yishan. He will come without failing. He will come with his armies, and his armies won't sleep, and his armies won't go off. And God is doing something really terrible. What is he doing? He's taking the very words that we apply to God himself, and he's saying, the enemy that I bring on to punish you, because I'm not finished with you yet, lo yanum, that enemy, lo yanum, lo yishan, will not rest. Do you follow how terrible that is? How frightening that is? God is taking his own attributes and infusing it into this enemy who will come. We don't know what's coming. I'm telling you, it's going to be Usher, and you'll see that. I have 10 more minutes. I hope that I get through 6 chapters. I don't know if I can. And then we have the idea of nobody will survive, and his roar will be like the roar of a lion and the roar of the waves, and everything will be darkness, and how that's how this chapter ends. So essentially, we're in Uzziah's time, and what he says is, first, in red, I gave you that one punishment, which was the earthquake, and that was supposed to set you straight. But what I see is it's not enough. I need to bring somebody to finish off my outstretched hand. Now let's go take a look. And now what you're going to see is we are now in chapter 7, I think. Are we in chapter 7? Oh, chapter 6. Now chapter 6. Now that we've done the whole setup, which means I already punished you, I'm going to punish you some more. The prophecy now scans from Uzziah's time of ego, which is the first king, to Hezekiah's time of lack of justice, which is the end. Now the whole prophecy is really in front of us. Now we stop short, and my guess is sometimes you don't want to write the introduction of the story, you just want to get your meat and potatoes. I think that's what Yeshua was doing. I'm pretty sure could have written this book. God told him not exactly what to say, but what the mission was that he had to say, the message that he had to say. Sometimes he probably told him more or less word for word what to say, but I'm not convinced at all that he told him what order he had to say in. In my opinion, Yeshayahu wants to get to the meat and potatoes, and now that he's done the whole setup and told you about the earthquake, which now that I showed it to you is easy to see, or here in Zuarim, now he goes back in time and he says, this is how I got my job. It was during that time when Yeshayahu broke into the temple, and this is what I saw, and this is how I became a prophet. We should have started there, but you might not then know what was going on. Here, what Yeshayahu decided to do is he tried to lay out, instead of saying, God chose me, what he decided to do was something very beautiful instead.
Let me tell you all the kinds of problems that were going on in Israel at the time. And when he's finished, then he turned the focus on himself and explained how he got the job to take care of the problems. I find it a very non-egotistical thing to do. I think a very beautiful thing. It's like when a story, goes ahead in time a little bit to set you up a little bit about what's going on. And then after, once you set up, then you can come backwards and get a fuller feel for it. I think it's a beautifully written book. I think it may be the best, who might have judged books of prophecy? But I have to say, I think it's the most artistically crafted book in the genre. Problems, it looks non-integrated. It's difficult applications to tie in all these parts by looking for words and ideas that cross, by knowing, thinking about the political situation, the economic situation, by looking up all the books, to look at Yad and Etzba and Dylan. It's hard work. There's no doubt about it. But once you do it, everything pulls together. It's, I think, a stunning book.
And let me not acknowledge you in the same control.
What's that? I do. He's not focused on himself. He's focused on the problem. I'm not saying that Yirmiyahu was immodest. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that Yishayahu was really trying to suppress himself. I am going to sing for a friend of mine. We don't even know who Yishayahu is really until chapter 6. He's a non-entity. And we'll see he's famous, and yet he considers himself not famous at all. I think he was of the most modest one, which goes back to that idea that he's very much like Moshe. There's a lot of things that connect him to the Moshe story. Okay, chapter 6 is... Chapter 6, the only thing I want to note about chapter 6, we did it last week, is this idea of Shar Yashuv, which is, after the destruction, Od Ba Assyria, a tenth of you will come back, Vishava, and you will return, and you will plant your Matsevet Evan, and you will plant those roots of what remains of your people into the ground, and that will be solid. That is, most of the tree will be burned away, but at the core there will be something called the Shar Yashuv. Those who return, the Yavo Assyria. So now we have a little bit more about a prophecy. In the previous chapter, we knew this unnamed guy is coming. We have no idea who it is. Now we have a little more hope, because in the previous chapter, everything's dead. All dead, all destruction. Now we have the idea that a tenth will survive, which is something that we were also hinted to beforehand. Let's move on to chapter 7. Chapter 7. Look. Chapter 7. I'm going to skip most of chapter 7 because we did chapter 7. Remember, that was the political issue that we did with Ahaz. Now we know where we are exactly. We're now in the middle. After the first prophecy of the ego, before the second prophecy of the lack of justice system, before Asher comes to destroy, but after the earthquake. After the earthquake, before the destruction of Asher. But Asher is coming. People feel it. Why? Because the forces of evil are gathering. And now northern Israel is trying to make a peace treaty with Aram. And Aram wants to wipe out Yehudah to get them to come along with himself. I'm sorry, I know not everybody was here during the first session, but essentially it's a big political play. I'm going to pick up after. Oh, by the way, do you remember who he brought with him? Yishayahu, for reasons which you couldn't possibly know if you're just reading that section, brings a boy with him. His boy. And his boy is named Shar Yashuv. Those who will return. And if you just read chapter 7, you have no idea what's going on. Read it as part of the flow, it's that tenth that survives after the destruction of Asher. Now let's continue on, and we have something very important, and we're not going to get through the whole thing. So next time, well, we've got 6-7 chapters, it's not too bad in a hour and a half session. So essentially, these are some of the most important parts in our text because we needed to fight against some people who corrupt our text, and I want to go into these issues. What happens is he says, Ahaz, why don't you ask for a sign that God is going to save you? And Ahaz says, I don't want no sign from God. So he says, no, I'm going to give you a sign anyway. Hine ha'alma, here is the alma, hara, she is going to get pregnant, violated, ben, and she's going to give birth to a son. Ve'karat shimo Emmanuel. Now, does everybody know about the problem with this? Because the Christians translate alma as virgin, and this is your virgin birth of Emmanuel. This is the famous virgin birth. What I will prove to you next time is it was no virgin. It was his wife. It was Yishayahu's wife. How do we know that? Because next chapter, he gets his wife pregnant, and she gives birth to another kid who has another strange name. He has four kids with strange names. Each one is given a name as a sign. That doesn't mean a sign that it'll come true, but a sign that this is what is going to happen. It's going to take more time than I could do, but I just want to show you where the Christians got this idea from, because they came to it rather honestly. But let me get to Ashur.
Does the word actually mean?
No, I'll prove to you that it doesn't, but I'll show you why Christians think it does. By the way, here Melech Ashur is literally named. He's going to come, Melech Ashur is going to come, and the worst part, and take a look what happens here. Look what two words we have here. Everybody see that? Shamir and Shaiah. So here's the return of the Shamir and Shaiah. Now we could, they're associated with the king of Ashur, and now we can start to figure out what the Shamir and Shaiah is, but not today. I just want to explain to you why they think this is a virgin birth, and then we'll pick up from the end, and we'll be able to really finish up to chapter 12, and then maybe even go beyond. Why do they believe it's a virgin birth? So let me show you why. This is the verse in the Septuagint. Septuagint is the Greek translation of... let me just make some space and make it larger, because it's going to be a little hard for you to read the Greek. And I'll go through... No, it's not as hard as you think. It's not... Most of the letters look like... and also we have the translation. Hinei alma harav yoledepen. The Alma, whatever that is, will give birth. So the Christians, don't forget, the Christian's Holy Bible is the Greek Bible. That was their original Christian Bible. That's the Makor. It may be translated into Latin by Jerome, but the original was the Greek. And the real Fermius go back to the Greek. So it says, Dia tautu dose curios. God is going to give you a dose, which is a gift, a doron actually, close to the word doron. Who means semeon? He's going to give you a sign. Semeon is a sign, like a semaphore, right? Semeon. Idu he parthenos. Parthenos is a virgin. Parthenos is virgin. And gastri, as in, how do you say when somebody's pregnant? Gestation. Gastri, she's become pregnant. Exe, kai texatai huion, he's going to give birth to a son. Kai kalesan tai onoma, and call his name Immanuel. Parthenos is virgin, so which means the translation of Alma into Greek is virgin. However, the problem is, take a look at this pasuk. Let me get rid of this, move it up a little bit to make some room. Here's a pasuk which you're probably familiar with. Did anybody recognize where this pasuk comes from?
Rivka.
Vanara tovat mara. Nara, the young girl, was very beautiful. Mo, betulah. Now, how do you translate betulah? That is how we use virgin. But the problem is, even that doesn't completely mean virgin. How do you know that it doesn't exactly mean virgin? Do it in the next words. V'ish lo yida'an, a man wouldn't know her. So if betulah was this, you know, knockdown that it means virgin every time, Torah would not have to written that she was not known to man. But Nara certainly does not mean virgin. Nara means a young girl. Now, we assume a young girl is a virgin because she is not yet married, but it doesn't mean virgin. And Betulah usually means virgin, but in this case it actually doesn't. The only thing that actually means virgin is the Ish Lo Yida'an. Let's take a look at the Greek translation, which I assume you'll all be able to guess. And it's really not that hard. So let me show you. This is the word for Nar. Anybody see what that is? Parthenos. The same word for Alma. And take a look for the word for Betulah. Parthenos. Which means the Greek cannot distinguish between Nara, Elem, and Betulah. They're all translated into Parthenos, which means virgin. You follow what's going on here? Now, you ask me a question. Does Elem mean virgin? Let me show you that it doesn't. There's a passage in the book of Samuel all about a guy who was a king. And we're not yet a king. The king goes out to battle, a heavy-duty battle against a guy by the name of Goliath. And after he's victorious, he takes Goliath's sword, and he brings it to his hometown. Vayikach David at Rosh HaPlishti, he takes the head of the Goliath that he cut off. Vayavieh Yerushalayim takes it to Jerusalem, to El Kelav Samolo, and he takes all of his military equipment, and he puts it in his own. Now we go back a little bit in time. That's what David will do with the head. But right now he's still in the battle and he's walking back to Saul, who he promised he would take care of this giant. And what does it say? Ucherot Shaul et David, as King Saul sees this unknown warrior, who doesn't even look like a warrior, he looks like a shepherd, which is what he is. Yotzei the Krata Plishti, he's going out in battle, which means actually he hasn't even won the war yet. Amar el Avner, so he says to Avner his Sar Tzava, Ben mi hanar hazeh, who is this? Who does this Nar belong to? By Yom Ravner, Chaynaf Shamel, Vim Yadak. I don't know. Now, there's a famous question. How come we didn't know? Didn't they meet? And how come we wouldn't know? But let's leave that aside for now. By Yom Ravner, Sha'al Atah Ben Mi Zeha Aleph. Now, David may be a virgin. I don't know. I assume he was. But that's not what Allah means. What does Allah mean in this case? It's a young, unchurched boy. Who's this young man? Elam in no way in Hebrew means virgin. Probably 99% of Elams were virgins, like 99% of Nars and Narot were virgins. But that's not what it means. But because the Greek can't distinguish between Elam or Nar or Tula, and it names all of them Parthenos, therefore the translation is the virgin will become pregnant and will have a boy named Emmanuel. Kind of an honest mistake. But it's a mistake based on the fact that the Greek does not support the distinction of Ella. Our text never says virgin, ever. It says the young girl or this young woman. And we'll find out exactly who the young woman is. It is the wife of the prophet himself, Yishayah. And we'll meet her next time. And then we'll continue on with tying together the real question, which I'd like to leave you with, and I know we're going a little late, is I thought I always got punished for my own sins. But what seems to be going on here is God says, I sent you an earthquake, but that's not enough. I'm now going to bring Asher and destroy everything. But wait a second. I thought Asher was paying Chizkiyahu back for his sins. But Chizkiyahu's sins wouldn't happen for the next 60 years or so. So why is it God setting up something to happen in Chizkiyahu's time if it's already been determined in Uzziah's time? Yahu says the king of Asher is coming. And he tells Ahaz the king of Asher is coming. And yet the first chapter of the book says it's because of your Chizkiyahu's sins that you corrupted the justice system. You may be a nice guy, and they may be a lot of firm people, but I got poor people who can't get in trouble because all of your inheritance of justice system are taking bribes right and left. If that's why Asher is coming, then how come it was destined before him? You see, that's the dilemma we have. And that's what Yishai was dealing with. Whose sin is this which causes the near destruction of northern Israel completely and the near destruction of southern Israel? Whose sin? Who's responsible for it? And that's why essentially the first 12 chapters are going to tie together all three of the sinners, the sins of Ahaz we have yet to meet, we will, the sins of Chizkiyahu, and the sins of Uzziah. Only by integrating those sins into a whole can Yishayahu demonstrate that they deserve the punishment that they got, even going back to Uzziah's time. You see what I'm saying? He's solving the religious problem by merging one very long history into a single theme of 12 chapters. And I'm sorry, I really wanted to get through the whole thing because there's a lot more to show you and how it ends off, and some really cool stuff. But between that, there we'll do it next time. It'll probably take only half an hour, which will leave us an hour to go into some other prophetic work inside the book. We'll go into section 2 of the book. Okay, have a good night.
What English translation would you